Well, good day to all you fine folks. My name is John Nelson, and I'm the head bookkeeper of the Colson Packet Company in Yankton, Dakota Territory. Now, head bookkeeper for a steamboat line may not sound like a very exciting job, but before that, I worked on Missouri River steamers for almost 40 years. And so folks always seem to be asking me about life on Missouri. They think there's some sort of adventure, excitement, and romance about life on the river. Well, the story they always seem to want to hear is the one about our trip last year up to the Little Bighorn. And I didn't see anything particularly romantic or adventurous about it, and there was more excitement there than anyone should have in their life. It was General Sheridan himself who made the contract with Commodore Colson and specifically requested that Captain Marsh be master and pilot. The captain had his choice of any of the company's boats, and he chose the Far West. Now that's a real mountain boat, shallow draft, 190 feet long, but light and fast, no frills or anything else unnecessary, not even railings on the upper decks. And she's a powerful boat, too, 15 by 5 engines. That's 15-inch pistons with 5-foot stroke, running on 130 pounds pressure from 3 22-foot boilers. Now, I'll admit that I had some misgivings about this expedition, but I trust Captain Marsh's abilities as pilot, and so I signed on as purser. I figured it would be an easy job, since as an Army charter, there would be no passenger fares or freight fees to calculate. Well, it was mid-May when we left Yankton and steamed up the Missouri to Fort Lincoln. And while we were unloading cargo for the fort and loading more supplies for the 7th Cavalry, the wives of the 7th Cavalry officers came aboard and asked Captain Marsh to take them up to the Yellowstone, where the officers and troops were encamped. Well, Captain Marsh believed the whole area to be far too dangerous for the ladies and simply refused the request. And I believe it was about May 28th when we left Fort Lincoln, had a full load of fuel and about 200 tons of cargo, drawing just over 30 inches of water. We met the 7th Cavalry at the Yellowstone and then steamed on up that river to the Powder, where we unloaded most of our cargo at the Army's supply camp. Sometimes the officers would ride the boat, and while we were moored at the camp, we were often visited by Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. Now, Captain Marsh and most other folks were considerably impressed by this gentleman, but first time I saw him, something about him, well, just seemed to rub me the wrong way. Maybe his swagger. Maybe the flashy touches he added to his uniform. Or maybe his long hair. Maybe it was all of that. Well, I talked to some of his fellow officers and learned that, well, maybe my first impression was right. Now, far be it from me to speak ill of the dead, you understand, but this is what the other officers told me. It seems he graduated from the military academy, last in his class, with one of the worst demerit records in the academy's history. He'd been court-martialed for dereliction of duty and for being absent without leave. He broke a treaty by attacking a peaceful Indian village and was out of favor in Washington because of some sort of dispute with President Grant and the Secretary of War. Nevertheless, General Terry put Custer in command of a considerable part of the force sent to find and defeat the Sioux and Cheyenne. It was June 22nd that Custer led the 7th Cavalry on that quest, with his hair and red scarf flowing in the breeze. I just watched from the door of my office with sort of a bad feeling in my guts. We were ordered to proceed up the Bighorn River. This proved to be a mighty difficult task, often steaming a few hundred yards, then warping or grasshoppering over gravel bars, steaming a few hundred yards, grasshoppering again. Sometimes we ran lines to the shore from both capstan winches and towed the boat over the shallows. And I think it was on the 26th that we noticed some columns of smoke off to the south. The next day, we finally tied up at the mouth of the Little Bighorn River. I joined several of the officers and crewmen to walk up the shore and get in a little bit of fishing. And we had just settled down on the bank when suddenly an Indian warrior burst out of the brush. We reached for our guns, but then we realized this was Curly, one of Custer's Crow Scouts. This young fellow, not even 20 years old, probably, he was absolutely terrified. Tears running down his face. He spoke very little English, but from his words and signs, it was clear to us that a disaster had occurred. We felt the need to do something, but our orders were to wait, and that's all we could do. The next day, an army messenger brought word that about 50 wounded men of Major Reno's command were being brought down the valley. We prepared most of the main deck as a hospital by making piles of prairie grass and placing blankets over them as beds. 2 days later, General Terry arrived with 52 wounded men from Reno's command. We took on as much fuel as we dared and prepared to head down the Bighorn. The general called Captain Marsh aside and said, "Captain, you have on board the most precious cargo a boat ever carried. Every soldier here who is suffering with wounds is the victim of a terrible blunder, a sad and terrible blunder." General Terry's words. Now, Captain Marsh is one of the strongest-willed men I know, but when he returned to the pilot house and stepped to the wheel, suddenly he lost his nerve. He said, "I can't do it, boys. We can't make the speed we need on this kind of river. We'll break her on a rock, and we'll lose all those brave boys." Well, the assistant pilot, Dave Campbell, Ben Thompson, the first mate, they got him calmed down. They told him, "You can do it, Captain. You're the only one who can do it." Well, Captain Marsh took a couple of deep breaths. He stepped back up to the wheel and rang the engineer for power. We were 2 days covering the 45 miles of the Bighorn, reversing our upstream struggle of a few days earlier. The roustabouts worked the spars and lines as fast as they could, risking injury or even death should a line snap or a spar fall. We met Colonel Gibbon's troops at the Yellowstone, replenished their supplies, and headed down toward the Missouri. Marsh and Campbell piloted in four-hour shifts, day and night. Ladies and gentlemen, one does not navigate the Missouri at night, much less the Yellowstone. But these two pilots did it. The firemen, the stokers, worked in shifts, keeping the boiler fires blazing without stop. The entire boat vibrated with the pounding of the engines. The paddle wheel thundered, and the escape pipes screamed at a pitch I'd never heard before. Dozens of times, the hull struck protruding stand bars, skewing the boat off course, throwing men to the deck, but never stopping, except for fuel, a burial, and to drop a scout at Fort Buford. At times, we were traveling over 20 miles an hour on a river that was impossible to memorize because it changed daily. After 54 hours, we arrived at Fort Lincoln, 710 miles from the Bighorn. That's averaging over 13 miles an hour, including our stops. I've seen more than my share of death and destruction on the boats, along the river, and during the war between the states. And most of that is what I'd call not heroic, but horrific. I know a lot of folks think that battle was something brave and heroic, glorifying it as Custer's last stand. As for me, I'll just take my cue from General Terry himself and call it Custer's last blunder. It's just a shame he took so many good men with him. And not to take anything away from those who were wounded or who died in the battle, but I think of my fellow officers and crewmen as heroes as well, for keeping the Far West running for 54 hours straight, bringing those wounded soldiers back. You might not agree with me, or maybe you do, but based on 53 years walking this earth and almost 40 years sailing its rivers, that's the way I see it. Thanks for listening.